Welcome to In the Garden, hosted by UC Master Gardeners. My name is Mark Fairley, and I will be your host today. And for your information, you are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and also, if I can get my information here together, the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the Board of Regents. For more information, go to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, I think. Anyway, get back to where we were. Today our show will focus on part two of spring vegetables. And we will have a special guest and vegetable expert. He is also a master gardener. And before I give away all his secrets, his name is Greg Stevenson. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Before we get started on our topic of the day, spring vegetables, Greg, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I usually introduce myself as a programmer by profession and an edible gardener by passion. I've been speaking publicly regarding edible gardening since 2010 and have been a master gardener since 2013. I also have interests in video production and film production and robotics.
Very interesting. How did you develop your interest in vegetables? Because I consider you my guru, my go-to guy.
Well, part of this, as I have mentioned in other occasions, that my wife got interested in green smoothies, and I got tired of paying a large amount of money to get a good price on vegetables just to have them go bad.
And they are expensive,
yes,
aren't they?
Go bad in there and not tasting as well. And so I got into gardening, and I basically became hooked. So, yeah, it is
addictive, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So listeners, keep that in mind. This can be addictive, particularly when you start to get good results. As someone told me, the three main reasons people stop gardening is bad results, weeds, and hard work. So if you like a little exercise, it's a good thing. But if you like good food and good vegetables that you will not get anywhere else, particularly in the store, grow your own. And that's what we're going to help you do today as part two. By the way, part one, we went through some basics of vegetable gardening so that you can have a successful garden, but it's more to than just the basics. It isn't rocket science. It's just doing good things that are scientifically appropriate. We don't have to create and invent a new wheel. So let's get going with some of that. Here we go. Okay. We talked about, before we get into the vegetables to grow for spring, let's talk a little bit more about compost.
Okay.
Because that is a basic ingredient of the nutrients that plants look for. They look for what? Nutrients and water for the most part. That's why they got roots for the most part.
And sun. That's why they have roots.
Sun,
yeah.
Right.
As well as anchoring them to the ground.
And just to kind of back up, sun is important, location, a nice level garden is appropriate where you're growing, because that's how water will stay without puddling.
Yeah.
And destroying your crops. I mean, isn't it true, Greg, most plants die because of too much water?
Usually overwatering is a problem. And one of the nice things, if you don't have a flat surface, is the fact that a drip irrigation system, if it's placed close to where the plants themselves are, it comes out at a slow enough rate that it gets absorbed rather than running off. So that's one good reason for using a drip system, plus controlling the amount of water so that you don't end up overwatering your plants and giving them.
We should talk about that a little bit too, but because drip irrigation can save a lot of water.
Absolutely.
And it can also, people, if they don't get the right equipment, they get the cheap stuff, whatever, they're not going to have, they get clogged up and do right.
You have to, it's not a panacea. It's something that you need to monitor. You need to have good equipment. And there are other different techniques for irrigating in different environments. But drip irrigation is one valuable tool to have in your gardener's toolbox.
Okay. Well, let's talk more about compost.
Yeah.
Then we'll go on to fertilizer, mm-hmm. because that is a component. If you don't have compost available, or you can't make it, or you want to buy it, are there some keys to buying compost?
Yes. It depends on how much you're going to use. Once again, I garden a lot, so my scale is a lot bigger than the average home.
And you use blended compost. What is blended compost?
I do not get my compost from any one source. And even if you're small, you can get, and I'll mention this, you can get it from several different sources. Just like when we eat, we don't eat just a given food item. Period.
Otherwise,
we get variety. We don't
get overwhelmed with one nutrient.
One set of nutrients or whatever. We need that variety, and that's how we can balance out. Or maybe this one nutrient isn't sufficient, but by having a variety, you've got that. So by usually having at least five different sources of compost, and sometimes I'll have six or seven, it depends on the year. It's and I just will blend those all together. I usually talk in terms of portions, which is roughly 10%. So I'll make 10 buckets full in a mixer and mix it together, but it will be from up to 5 to 7 sources, and sometimes I'll use one or two buckets of a particular thing, maybe three, depending. Just depends on the time of the year and how much I have of any given type of compost at that point in time. But generally, a variety is good. There are, in our local Orange County area, there's a couple of places that sell bulk compost, and that's a good variety. A good way of getting at least a source of compost if you're going to be using a lot of it, because usually they require you to get like a whole truckload, and that's not appropriate for a lot of people.
One question that I have that is very important. Compost is something that has rotted. Is that correct?
It's
organic, it's decomposed product that is basically rotted.
Almost all sources, it has either been broken down by bacterium or it's been broken down by earthworms in the case of compost.
And what is in that makes up that organic material.
Absolutely.
It is very important to make sure the compost that you buy is well composted.
Absolutely.
And how do you determine that?
If it's not active, and one of the things is if it's warm, it's still probably breaking down and doing its thing. When it starts getting to, because in a biological thing, it's a These are what they call thermophilic bacteria. They love heat and they generate heat, and it can actually get up to 160 degrees and sometimes even more, very, very warm. And when it gets back down to, and this isn't a hot composting technique, when it goes back down, but if something's not well composted, generally it'll start putting off heat because it's just a natural thing that the bacteria.
So just put your hand on it. Yeah. If it's hot and not necessarily in the sun as a result, but go on to a different.
You go on to a different one, or you set it aside and let it go until it finish the rest of it. Yeah, so there's a couple of ways of doing it.
Now, one other question with compost.
Mm-hmm.
Over a period of time, it loses some of its nutrient value. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Generally, is there a time frame on that?
Well, I
don't know.
I use it very quickly after I create it, so it's not there. Some people say a year, 2 years, but there's always some value to it, even if it's only for creating structure to the soil, not just nutrients.
True. And that's one of the things
it helps
does.
Hold water. It helps keep the soil loose and friable, which is good for the roots spreading out, especially on vegetable plants, things like that.
Good. That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
I think that's important. People can buy their compost wherever they want to. They can make it themselves. They can buy some. Get different varieties. They have different ingredients. Some may be redwood. Some might be something else.
Yeah. Look at the ingredients. You don't want something that has sand or soil in it or other things. That's more of a soil, a potting soil or something like that. But sometimes they say it's a garden soil, and sometimes even though it says it's a soil, it may just be pure compost. So you can look at the ingredients to see whether or not they've added anything like sand or something. If it's not there, but it's mainly wood or there's one company now that has a variety of compost, which is just composted vegetables. They actually get the discarded vegetables from certain large places, and they've created compost from that. Earthworm castings are another form of compost. As you mentioned, wood chips, horse manure, chicken manure. These are all well composted. In a lot of cases, they've actually added wood products to it to aid with the composting.
I gotcha.
And those are all available from local nurseries.
Yeah, local nurseries.
So you can get a variety even if you don't have a large quantity.
Good advice. Let's go on to fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not using compost, you're probably going to have to use some kind of a fertilizer because, from what I understand, our natural ground has about 3 to 5% of nutrients in it.
Which is okay. There's, a difference between when you're growing vegetables and maybe trees, which aren't trying to get all their nutrients from this. And so the other thing is that you don't want to blend compost in too deep in the ground because compost still needs air and stuff to react. And if you go any deeper than the top 6 inches,
shutting it off,
you'll shut it off and you'll end up with anaerobic actions, which are bad for the plant as opposed to being good. But nutrients, if you can, and I usually mix a couple of fertilizers in with compost that I'll put in the top layer.
Doesn't hurt, as long as it's organic, right?
I still advocate, personally for me, organic things, and this is usually...
Because they're not petroleum-based.
They're not petroleum-based, and they're usually animal products. And then there are some people who don't like to use animal products. They won't use bone meal or blood meal or something like that. But there are also there's kelp or other sources that you can, kelp meal in that, which you can use. The one thing that you can use to tell a fertilizer from a compost is compost will not have a designation. You usually see three numbers, which indicates a chemical analysis that tells you the percentage of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus in it. Actually, it goes NPK, so nitrogen, phosphorus, and then the potassium. Those are the three numbers that you'll see. And if it has that, that's a fertilizer. If it doesn't have that, it's not a fertilizer. And if it's usually a designation like manure or that, it'll be a compost of some sort.
Correct. And when you see those three letters, it can be one is higher. If, for example, if the N is high, you want to be careful using it. If the P is higher, or both the P or the K, that's okay for blossoming plants.
Yeah, it's nitrogen is the one that usually gets really up there.
It's a green
the first one.
It's for greening.
You know, green things. But if it's too high, and this is even true of a natural product, you can get some, for example, chicken manure or blood meal in particular, it might be 21 or something. And anything higher than 10, you really need to dial back.
Be careful.
And be careful putting it. Now, you can use it. It's just that you need to dilute it for way down than something that you would use normally.
But organic fertilizer with a balanced NPK is what you're really looking for your vegetable garden.
It's a good way to go. Another thing is that in the beginning of the year, you might have something with a little bit higher in and lower on the other one. So one might be 6 and the others are 3 and 2 or something like that. When the plants start blooming, if you're going to add fertilizer at that point in time, then you want something with more phosphorus, and then potassium, so good all around.
Because that will help create the blossoms
in the fruiting. Yeah.
Good. Okay, I think we've covered fertilizer as much. We normally don't give out to our listeners' names, but
right.
But that's okay.
Most garden centers, they have it, and you can go for the... Yeah, they have the packaging. They'll state whether or not it's organic.
Good. Before we get into our vegetables, sunlight. We talked in our earlier program, part one of this group, about 6 to 8 hours of sun is needed. Is that correct? What's more important, AM sun, PM sun?
Depends on what you're growing. AM sun is better for things that are fruiting. So if you only have one or the other, put the things that are going to be producing fruits, and that includes things like tomatoes, strawberries, cucumbers, zucchinis, anything like that. So they get more of that morning and early afternoon. Late afternoon sun is actually a little better for some of your plants that generally are considered your cooler plants, the green leafy plants and things like
gotcha.
That.
Gotcha, okay. How about seeds versus transplants?
Yes.
Can you give us a good answer? Both of them are good.
Both of them are good.
Any thoughts on if we want to plant from seed?
Planting from seed generally takes...
Tips.
Yeah. It's generally a little harder. It's not hard, but it's just generally a little harder. Especially if you're impatient, because the transplants will give you a jump on
that. Instant gratification.
They will get you usually 3 to 4 weeks of faster than sprouting from seed. But seeds have a lot of advantages. One is that when you go look for transplants, there's only a few varieties that you can get in a transplant, whereas seeds, the seed catalogs just have hundreds and thousands of different varieties. You know, one seed catalog I know has over 5,000 varieties of tomatoes, and most have, you know, at least 50, if not 100, whereas if you go to some place that has transplants, maybe a half a dozen at most. Some of the better places might have a few dozen different varieties. So you have more variety if you are able to go with seeds. Seeds are also a lot cheaper than transplants. You usually get 6 plants when you go get a pack of transplants, maybe 1. And a little tip on picking things for transplants, they usually come in 6-packs, 8-packs, or singles. And the singles are a lot more expensive, and yet those things that you have in the 6-packs, in just about a week, maybe 2 at the most, they're
right there
with the other ones. So you always look for the quantity one. One of the bad things is also you might not want 6 of one variety. One of the nice things they've been doing the past couple of years, especially with peppers and tomatoes, is you can buy a 6-pack that will have 6 different varieties of peppers or tomatoes or something, so you can get a nice variety.
I've seen that,
right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so that's nice for people. Usually when people are beginners, I usually recommend starting the first year with the transplants just because they're easier and they get more instant gratification.
Can you give us some good tips on how to plant transplants? You don't just stick them in the ground, right?
Okay, first, as we talked, you want to have the soil prepped. You want to make sure that your transplants are well-watered before
being well-hydrated.
Well-hydrated.
Any suggestions on how you do that?
I'll tell
you how I do it. I just take a bucket of warm water, sun warm water, I would call it, and dunk them in. And what that does is after about a day of sitting, and what that does is get them hydrated and just put them all the way in. Dunk them, put them on the, get them on the bottom. They're not going to drown.
No.
You can keep them there for 5 minutes. It'll do 2 things. It'll, one, get them hydrated, and number 2, it'll kill any pests. It'll drown any pests that may be on them, even though there shouldn't be.
There sometimes will be some. I often just fill a tray. It's filled with water, and I'll put the 6-packs in there. It wakes up in there and leaves it there for an hour or so. They'll be fully hydrated. Plants are amazing at how quickly they can absorb water up to their full potential. So.
And if they get a good start, you got a much better chance of making it, right?
And then usually with the hole, the ground is usually very friable. That's very loose when I deal with it because I've already prepared that. So I usually just use my fingers to make a hole. You can use a spade or anything. It's not very much. And then when you take it out, and this is an important thing, one of my tools that I have has a little jagged edge, almost like a serrated knife. And what I use that for is when you pull out a lot of transplanted plants, one of the bad things about transplants is if they're left in too long, they have the roots growing around in a circle, and they will tend to grow that way rather than spreading the roots out if you don't do something. So what you need to do is I take that and I go on 8 sides in the middle of each one, and at the corner I cut that, and then I just peel it away with my finger, and then on the bottom it's usually a big clog there, and I just pull that off all the way.
So you're getting excess, so they're not root
bound. So I'm getting rid of those things, and they call that root being root bound, and then just sort of squish it lightly with my hands, but they don't have to do too much because being moist like they are,
less is better.
Yeah,
but just to kind of get them.
Just get waking up and
kind of
stimulating everything there. And I also make sure that I've poured some water into the hole that I'm going to put them in, because that'll drain away fairly quickly, but it makes sure that the ground around where it's going and will also be moist. Then I'll put them in, and then I'll come back maybe an hour or two later, just try to do some of this towards the evening. and I don't want to get the plants itself wet, but just moisten the ground just a little bit more to give it that little bit of extra. And this is especially true during the summertime when it's very warm out. You want to do this in the evening, give them that full night of nice moisture. They can start the roots growing again. And they grow these little root hairs very quickly, and that's how they get most of the water in. So doing that and keeping them, the critical part is keeping them nice and moist till they get the roots established.
Good. That handles transplants pretty well, I think. How about seeds?
Seeds, one of the biggest things most people do, they look at the packet, but also look at the size of the seeds. So I've found many packets where the packets were wrong. They will tell you to plant, they will tell you to surface sow in one paragraph, and then the diagram will say plant at a half inch deep.
Interesting.
No, normally you do not plant a seed any deeper than twice its size. So if it's a very tiny seed, this means that it's basically right on the surface. They call that surface sowing, or just lightly sprinkled. And a lot of your seeds like tomatoes and lettuce and that are very, very tiny seeds, carrots and so on. Bigger seeds like squash and that, you can see they're a little bit bigger seeds, so yes, you go down about a half an inch, or peas or beans or things like that. They're bigger seeds, so they go down a little bit deeper, but not real deep. The plant can adjust. If it's too deep, what happens is it has food and energy inside that seed, and it's just barely enough for it to get up to the surface so it can have its first leaves come out and start making its own food. And if it's too deep, it runs out of food before it gets to the surface.
Before it gets there, and so it's...
So, usually, and a little shallower is better.
What I've found is that most novice gardeners plant too deep.
Yes. Very often plant too deep. And so when you see those seeds, it's better to be too shallow than too deep.
Good advice.
The other thing is make sure your ground is moist and stays moist. And I usually put a layer of compost on top because compost is good at retaining it. Not very deep, just a slight layer keeps it on there. And that also tells me that if it's starting to dry out a little bit, I know that underneath it, it should still be wet, but it might be there, but I'll go ahead and I'll keep it moist.
Very good.
And be patient. They sometimes take a long time to come up.
Isn't that the truth? Some of them in particular, like carrots and onions, they grow at their own pace, don't they? Beets are great, though. I love beets, to grow beets.
Yeah.
Let's get into a few of the crops we want to plant. Now, you talked in our program, our first program, about warm season crops, and when do we determine their warm season?
Well, my biggest criteria for a warm season crop is something that is producing fruit, with the exception of peas, because they need that warmth and a lot of sunlight in order to produce their fruit. So zucchinis, cucumbers, tomatoes, of course, strawberries and most fruit trees, those are all things that need a lot of sunlight and a lot of warmth in order to produce that fruit.
You can put them in, but they're not necessarily going to produce anything until it gets warm.
Right, absolutely.
And then they'll pop it and really go quick.
And then the other criteria is a lot of plants, basil is one that comes to mind, but they don't like frost or freezing. They're not cold tolerant, so you want to make sure that there's no chance that there's going to be a freeze that in a given morning or night.
So if we call warm season, that's normally 75 to 95 degrees.
Yes, yeah. And usually
cool season,
55
to 75.
Yeah.
If I understand that.
Yeah. But since we have a mild climate, we can get away with
a lot of it all year round. Yeah. Isn't that the truth? We are blessed. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, be careful about buying gardening books. Most books that are written about gardening are gardening for the East Coast. And if you're up north, you got snow and frost and frozen ground and wet ground. And if you're down south, like in Florida, you can't grow anything from May to October. So be careful about buying gardening books that are from the East Coast, because they don't apply to our gardening for the most part.
Now that you have the internet, you can put in search terms like growing vegetables in Orange County and come up with a chart. And a lot of these charts are from the University of California Cooperative Extension. You'll see.
Which are the scientists that we rely on and as a part of the Master Gardener program.
They'll give you a good rule of thumb, the months to start in that. But in general, your warm ones.
Let me just take a break here for a second to let our listeners know they are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thank you very much, Greg. Good point, though. I really like what you talked about. That is good advice. And there are things that people ordinarily don't think about.
Right.
But gardening books is one. It's a very interesting topic. But using the internet,
And for your locale. So even if you're listening and you're not in Orange County, you can find something. But yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about some of our plants. Now, let's start off with what I call one of the two things money can't buy. Do you know what that is? Well, I'll tell you what it is. Two things money can't buy: true love and homegrown tomatoes. In fact, there's a great song. I use it on a radio show all the time. It's called Homegrown Tomatoes. In any event, let's talk about tomatoes for a few minutes. It is considered normally a warm season crop, wouldn't you say?
I'd agree.
They like sun, probably 75 to 95. Over that, they won't blossom or produce. But let's talk about planting them. Are you a big tomato guy?
I usually grow 10 to 15 varieties a year.
Are there some varieties that you like better than others?
For the novice gardener, and even for myself, I grow a lot of small tomatoes, usually like the cherry type, and they could be in a variety of different colors. I love the ones that they're so dark they look black from any distance, or a dark purple. Wonderful taste and flavor to them.
They are the smaller tomatoes. I've found are the tastier ones.
And then the red and yellow and white, just because they make a nice collection in a salad or something when you dice them up.
Absolutely. And they have a little different taste.
I've always loved they're called, they're a pear shaped. They look like little yellow white things.
I forget what the variety is. I've got some information on that, but I'm not going to spend time looking at it here.
It'll come to me, but not right now. Then I use the medium-sized ones. I'm not a big fan of the big beefsteaks and that, just because of the way I use them. I usually use them in salads or smoothies, and not
sure.
so much
You're
for slicing
eating.
On
right.
Hamburgers or something
and
like
there
that.
Are different varieties of
yeah.
tomatoes that primarily are used for different purposes.
Right. And then I will, and then I'll usually grow two or three beds. My wife loves making tomato soup and that, so we'll have some of the tomatoes that have a lot of pulp, like the Romas and the Marzano.
Sauce tomatoes.
Just four sauces, yeah. A lot of meat to them.
Right. Types of tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed on some of the varieties transplants that I buy, one of them says a determinant or an indeterminate.
Yes, indeterminates, once they start producing fruit, keep producing fruit for pretty much the entire season. They'll slow down as the temperature starts cooling down. Determinate tomatoes.
A determinate
tomato generally comes to bloom all at the same time, and that's the ones that farmers usually use because they can use to predict it, and they can go out and they can harvest the entire field at one
sure.
particular point in time.
But we as we like to eat our tomatoes one or two at a time.
Yeah.
Pick them off. And
so the indeterminate is usually what most home gardeners pick, although I have found that there are several determinate varieties that, although they do produce the bulk of it at one point in time, they'll keep producing all year long if you want to keep them around. It's not that they just give up and go, except for very specific varieties that a lot of the farmers use.
And often tomatoes here will grow because they're really a perennial but are primarily used as an annual
yes.
here in Southern California in most places. But if we don't get a frost, they can continue.
Yes, I always leave at least a couple of plants to produce, as well as there are some cooler season varieties that will grow during what we consider our winter, but
right.
it's very warm. It's like the summers in a lot of the cooler places where these varieties are from.
Right, I got you. Let's, a couple things about plant. About it. Let's say we select it to grow a transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Any idea what we should be looking for when we pick a transplant? For example, I look at them when I go to, for example, a home improvement
mm-hmm.
center, and I see all kinds of the same variety. Some of them have multiple stems, some are singular,
mm-hmm.
and they're all mixed in among themselves. Is there any apparent advantage to having a double over a single, other than dividing the nutrients?
Two coming up, or
no? Two coming up. One.
Well, okay. There's two aspects to this. One of the unique things about tomatoes is that they, on their stem, anything that's covered with ground will grow additional roots.
How is that?
It's just the nature of the plant.
They got those little hairs on
the little hairs, and they'll come out there. They'll produce roots if they're under the ground. And so what you want to do, or at least this is what I do, is I use buckets for my tomatoes.
Good.
5-gallon buckets. And other people use tubs.
Sure.
So they might be 13, 20 gallons or whatever, or half wine barrel, whatever. And I actually dig all the way down to the bottom and plant the thing just about as far as I can go, and then take all the leaves off except for two or three at the very top, And if it's forked off, I'll pinch off one of those to just keep a single stem coming up. And then let that grow. And then as cover it with dirt. And as it gets taller, I do the exact same thing up until it's to the level of my thing. And that creates a very large root base so that it can get all the nutrients and a lot of water from. Because as these...
And you produce more blossoms as a result? And
yes, it's a much healthier plant and much healthier. And then as it starts growing up, there's what's called a single stem method. I vary this a little bit, and I allow three stems to go up. But as it comes out and they start branching off, I let one or two leaves go, and then I pinch it so it doesn't grow anymore. And there's basically two types of offshoots from the tomato plant, one set are for leaves and branches, and the other one for fruit. And they will keep producing up until they get to the top. And then by having three of those, I can then go, and if there's no more fruit production on that, I can let another one come out from the side and grow off the other one and grow up and just start the process
because
over again.
Because tomatoes grow up.
If you have a trellis or something.
Yeah.
You need to have a trellis or something to let them grow up.
Yes.
That way you can have a lot of varieties in a very small amount of space, too. That's one of the reasons why I use the 5-gallon buckets, so I can have all these different varieties in a very small amount of space.
And that's very important. Spacing when you plant, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that correct? Should be at least a foot and a half or 2 feet, and if you can do more than that, that's fine.
Yeah. But
then you can let it bloom or grow, but pruning the lower branches will keep it growing up, and that's where your tomatoes are going to grow.
Your blossoms will vary there.
Yeah. Okay. As far as location goes, how it's important that it gets good sun, because you're not going to get the blossoms,
mm-hmm.
and you're not going to get the forever production as long as it will last.
Right.
But is it important to rotate the location of your tomatoes every few years?
Yes and no. You've got one of two choices. Tomatoes, if you grow tomatoes in soil 1 year, you should not grow tomatoes or any other member of the nightshade family. That includes, so you don't grow eggplant the next year or something like that, potatoes or anything, tomatillos or something like that, because there are certain soil-borne pathogens and other harmful things that can live in the soil, so you want to put something else in there. And that's one of the reasons, and again, why I used buckets, because I don't rotate. I need to have those tomatoes in the sun all the time, but I don't need to have a tomato in that particular bucket all the time. So the first year, that'll have a tomato. The second year, it might have cucumbers. The next year, it might have zucchinis, and then I'll go back and use that particular bucket with its soil.
Where do you get your buckets?
Buckets are available. This is a personal thing that I have, is my neighbor owns the busiest Rocky Mountain chocolate candy factory in the nation.
Oh, my goodness. And so, how did you get that lucky?
So not everyone has that. But I will tell you, before I found out that he was throwing buckets away every week, and I have hundreds, I love 5-gallon buckets. I do all sorts of growing and other things in them. Go to places, your stores and that. I was getting them, the big stores or whatever. Just talk to the people who are back in the deli sections or whatever. All sorts of stuff come in, and they come in these large buckets, and they're food-grade plastic. I usually soak them, and it makes it easier with a spatula to peel off the label.
Yeah.
And then I just use it. They can be decorated, so they look very nice, and they're very useful. And if you look online again for ideas of growing things in 5-gallon buckets, there's just tons of different ways you can grow with
5-gallon buckets.
That's about the smallest size that
Bakeries, too, I think.
Bakeries, donuts, you know, any place donuts, that has stuff like that. They use it a lot, and very common.
Okay.
So they're usually free because they're throwing them out. They might charge you a small amount.
So be careful with your... with your location or keeping them in the same place.
Right. You either have to rotate the soil or rotate the location. And it's hard to rotate the location because we usually don't have a whole lot of space.
Okay, we talked about pruning and rotating locations. Seeds is another thing, growing from seeds. Do you grow from seed? Or?
Yes, because a lot of the varieties I get, I usually have a handful that are more common varieties, but I always try 4 or 5 varieties each year that I've never tried before.
Any good tips on growing from seed?
I use a seed mat to warm them, and
what is that?
That is just a little flat mat.
Like a heating pad.
Like a pet heating pad. As a matter of fact, I've used pet heating pads. And
Want them to get too hot.
Just raise the temperature of the soil about 10 to 15 degrees, but unless you get things started, a little bit earlier, you can grow them in the house. If you have a grow light, and those come now that the LEDs are out, they're a little expensive right now, but they're very handy because they don't generate any heat, but the light, you can position the light very easily, and it gives them a lot of light. You can start them indoors that way.
How early before you're going to plant?
Usually I allow 6 weeks or so, because I want them
before to... Before you're going to actually...
Before I transplant them.
Transplant.
Out of the... So it'll take 10 to 15 days before they even start breaking ground, and then a little... And then you need to get at least 4 or 5 leaves. I like to have them about 6 inches tall.
So they're not so delicate.
Yeah.
The little ones are so delicate.
Now, you will also find that they, once you have these, because the birds will pick off fruit, and that you will start seeing seedlings growing all over the place. But I would classify those as weeds and resist the urge to grow them, because you really don't know what variety they are.
Gotcha.
So,
It's amazing. Tomatoes are a great thing. There's some good basics to use. Follow the directions on the seed pack. Use good common sense. And if you have pests, any ideas on pests?
For the most part, I have 3 pests that happen with tomatoes. The tomato worms, which we talked in the last episode, and you can use the spray BT for that. And then those are the hornworms. The other 2 things that I find are rats and birds.
Ah, and yeah, they like the rats and birds.
And trapping is one of the best ways of dealing with that. You can look on the University of California's IPM website, upm.ucdavis.edu, which is a very good site.
Could you
site.
Repeat that?
ipm.ucdavis.edu, and that is got a lot of good information there. There are also some diseases that tomatoes can get. You need to look for those. The leaves seem to be yellowing or deformed or anything like that.
And viruses and
different things. If you rotate the soils and take good care of your plants, those are a little bit less likely to occur. However, if you do see something, you're just suspicious of it, put it in a bag, put it in the freezer to kill it, and then take it to somebody, a garden center or something, to help you identify with it.
Particularly a garden center like an Armstrong's or somebody
that have a good reputation.
Yeah.
And you can also take a picture of it and send it to the UC Mass, the Gardeners Hotline.
Sure.
Well.
Use the hotline. That is hotline@uccemg.com. Send them an email and with your problem. Give them a good description, and if you can't, send them a picture. You'll get an answer within a few days from the scientists, et cetera, that the master gardeners refer to when they have a problem. We have common problems, pests like hornworms, cutworms, and they generally have the same solution to the problem. Pick them off and dispose of them safely.
And the trick that I mentioned last time, if you go out with a black light, which are pretty easy to find online as well.
And most molds and viruses spray with BT, as I understand.
Not so much. BT is very specific and only for the worms in that. If you have a mold or a virus, one powdery mildew or things like that, neem oil is
a good,
or sulfur.
And
you can find these at the garden centers.
Available at the garden centers.
Environmentally, having good soil and not overwatering, you won't have too many problems.
Okay. Let's go one more. Environmental disorders like blossom end rot. Normally a watering problem, as I understand.
Watering, sometimes a lack of not enough phosphorus in the soil, but overwatering is usually a very common
and
cause.
The same with fruit cracking.
Yeah. Oh, right. Fruit cracking is always, because that's irregular watering. Too much watering and not enough
Well, Greg, we've just about expended our time here. Thank you very much for being a part of this two-part program on spring vegetables. Gave a lot of advice. Look on the on your seed packs. Look on the tag on your transplants to when to plant them. Spacing is so important. Watering, etc. But they are not rocket science. Just good common sense. These things have been growing, and they're hardy, and they're in today's crops are hybrids, many of them, and they're growing to be disease resistant.
Yep, and tomatoes.
Any final thoughts?
Well, tomatoes, people are afraid, because we talk about all sorts of, there's a lot of advice on the perfect way of growing tomatoes. But people also have to realize tomatoes are basically a weed that has a good tasting fruit. And so, even if you don't do things perfectly, you'll still get a better tasting tomato than you would at the store.
That's for sure. And it's amazing. One of the reasons for that is, I understand, is that stores don't buy tomatoes for their taste. They buy them and cultivate them for their looks and how long they will last. So that
how well they ship. Yeah.
How well they ship. And oftentimes it takes sometimes 2 to 3 weeks for them to get to our local grocery store. And so nothing is better than true love and homegrown tomatoes. Listen to our show Thursday mornings, 8:30 to 9:30 a.m., KUCI 88.9 FM, and it's hosted by Master Gardeners. Thank you very much, and see you next week.